This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and this week thought we'd sit down with three smart people from diverse backgrounds, all talented and respected in their fields, and talk about the week's news and whatever else comes up. Jazz great Branford Marsalis is here. He's been in the music industry for more than 30 years, a Grammy Award winner who's made lots of albums and collaborated with The Grateful Dead, Miles Davis, Public Enemy, Mary Chapin Carpenter, and Sting, just to name a bunch. Arlie Petters is also here, leading mathematician and physicist. He grew up in Belize and actually studied under a kerosene lamp, but his work in math and astronomy have him looking up at the cosmos. Arlie Petters is a professor of mathematics, physics, and business administration at Duke University, and Juliana Makichi Nfa-Abinyi is a scholar of African literature and fiction writer as well. She is from Cameroon and a professor of English and comparative literature at North Carolina State University. Welcome to all of you. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Juliana, you recently wrote an essay in 27 Views of Raleigh called Home is Where You Mend the Roof, and it talks about your experience as an immigrant in America. And I want to take a moment to reflect on that personal experience you had and think about the question of Syria, not so much from American foreign policy, but the refugees, people who are displaced because of that conflict, and your experience as an immigrant.
I have traveled and moved around a lot in my life. From Cameroon, I lived in Montreal, Canada for a number of years, then came to the United States. And it has occurred to me that every time I move, I have to begin all over again. Whether you are here for 6 years or over here for 7 years or 10 years, you begin to create a sense of community, a sense of place, a sense of rootedness. And then you move, and then it's as if you have to begin all over again. And so when I watch what is happening in Syria, I don't think about all the other things that people want to talk about, the bombs and all of that. I think about those refugees because war for me, it's about the details of everyday life. What is happening to those people? When they wake up in the morning, is this child going to eat? Is there going to be water? There's a Ugandan writer called Goretti Kiyomohendo. She wrote a novel called Waiting. And in an interview, she told the interviewer, when I go to a refugee camp and I look out on the people there, the first thing I think is, what do the women do when they have their period? And she said, that's the difference between a woman who writes about war and a man who writes about war. Mm. Male authors would not automatically think, what do the women do when they have their period? And yet, that's what she automatically thinks about first. Those very fundamental, basic things that confer human dignity, that confer identity, that confer a sense of who we are. War takes all of that away. And when I see refugees, that's what I think about. They have to begin all over again. You come to a place, people welcome you, and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to, this is just temporary. You know, in a few weeks, in a few months, I'm going to go back. And the people are also hoping that in a few weeks, in a few months, you're going to go back. And then before you blink, it's 5 years, it's 10 years. And people are thinking, how much longer are you going to be here? So automatically, tensions begin over simple things like, we don't have water to share with these people. We don't have food to share with these people. And for me, that is fundamentally what is at stake. The details of everyday life that we don't talk about or we don't think about when we talk about war, whether it's in Syria or any place in the world.
Well, Arlie Petters, you also have an immigrant experience in this country, coming from Belize and then finishing your education in this country. When you hear what Juliana says about the details, it makes you wonder if the people who were actually doing the planning thought about those things, if that's what was on their mind, how very different things might turn out.
Yes, I agree so much that it is all about the details. Along with what Juliana said, I always wonder, what do little kids think about? Do they have nightmares at night? And when you look at the parents, imagine that state of shock and uncertainty that goes hour by hour. That, to me, is what grips me whenever I think about Syria. And now, if I should take my own personal experience coming to the U.S., there's also a state you're in as an immigrant of not belonging anywhere. And I remember as a teenager when I came here about age 14, I remember for the first time someone calling me the N-word. And I also remember for the first time a student calling me a coconut. And I said, wait a minute, I'm not fitting in any category here. I'm in no man's land. And imagine now you take this kind of psychological assault of signals where you want to come and better your life. You're here to work hard. And if you now look, say, at kids in Syria or people wanting a new opportunity, I can imagine where I was when I came to the U.S. is far beyond what they can imagine, where they're worrying about food, clothing, and shelter, right?
Well, and if you think about these basics, too, I mean, Branford, you're somebody who was born in the United States. You're an immigrant to Durham. So welcome here, and we'll check your papers on the way out. But you've had the experience of growing up in this country. Does any of this resonate with you? And if so, how?
Well, it resonates for me because I happen to grow up in the northernmost Caribbean city in the world, New Orleans. So when I moved to the East Coast in 1979, and this is before cell phones and before YouTube, and so everything is just rumor and innuendo. I left a town that has a completely different cultural sensibility than the rest of the country, and welcome the culture shock. You have to change the way you talk. You don't have to, but you do. Mm. You have to get used to eating really bad food all the time. You have to get used to people who don't really have a sort of music that roots them culturally. The radio roots most Americans culturally. So my first few years here was very strange for me. I'm sure it was not as dramatic as coming from Africa, you know, coming from Cameroon, suddenly switching from French to English as a primary language, which is its own cultural trip unto itself. But it was quite a shock, and it took me a few years to figure out where I belonged. And it helped for me because there were a lot of New Orleans people everywhere, and we kind of found each other. And
you got to admit, the food's getting better here.
No, the food's really good here.
Yeah, there you go.
But I mean, in 1979, I wasn't here. I was in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
Food's getting better there, too, I hear, but it wasn't very good then.
Juliana, but this idea then about becoming rooted, you address that in your essay in 27 Views of Raleigh in the sense that you can think that you're finally assimilated or into the culture, and then there's that phone call.
Exactly. Every time you think, now, you know, I'm an American citizen now, and yet there are many ways in which things happen in my daily life that always force me to question my American citizenship, whether I like it or not, and whether I want it or not. And it's just little things that happen, you know, every day, you know, in your life. For instance, I applied for a mortgage to buy my house, the house in which I live right now. And at one point, the bank representative asked for the photocopy of my passport. And I was really, really shocked by that request, because I know that my American friends have never been asked for a photocopy of their passport. Before coming to Raleigh, I had owned a house in Hattiesburg, Mississippi for 10 years. So I have been a good citizen before even coming here. And so when someone says, you know, I want a photocopy of your passport, you're suddenly thinking, they looked at my name, Juliana Makochinfa-Abenyi, and they're like, who the hell is this? Must be one of those foreigners. I need to see her passport. You know, little things like that. And then things that happen back home, you know, what was home for me before, like the death of a brother or the death of a sibling, you know, you dread hearing your phone ring at 2 o'clock in the morning. And when my phone rings at 2, 3 a.m., more often than not, someone is seriously sick or someone is dead. So when you pick up that phone, I always just ask, who's dead? Let's establish that first. And then, oh, no, everything is okay. So who's seriously sick? And so there is that consistent, like I said, those little things that happen every single day that are constantly forcing you to you know, to be aware of who you are, to be aware of where you are, to be aware of what it means to consistently, you know, seek rootedness, you know, establish that American citizenship, because every single time you're being forced to rethink it. You're being forced to think, that you are not an American. And there are many, many examples that happen that way. And so that's why you always feel like you're picking up the pieces every single time. You feel comfortable. I've been here for 8 years. You feel like, this is great. I'm a Raleighite. And then something happens. You're like, oh, my God, I'm not. Yeah.
But it really raises a question. If you're trying to make policy in the light of these are the individuals, these are the people who make up your population, all of them dealing with these fragmented, our own fragmented identities and bringing all sorts of different expectations and senses of disorientation. And then you sort of have this lofty policy decisions that are made sort of at an intellectual level above. And it's like, well, how's that even going to play out in these various camps and places? A place like – and you, Branford, talked about growing up in New Orleans, a place where people are refugees even today coming back after Katrina.
Right. It's a lot different than it was 5 years ago. But that was – yeah. Mm-hmm. That was – just thinking about that brings back – I mean, people were separated from their children on boats when they say we only have room for two. And they'd take the kid, and then the kid would be sent to Utah, and the mom would be sent to Michigan. And then they have to try to sort it out from there and put it back together. It was a really, really traumatic experience for a lot of people in the city.
We're having a lunchtime party today, a roundtable conversation about the news and whatever else comes up with Branford Marsalis, Arlie Petters, and Juliana Makachi and Fa Benye. And we're continue that conversation when our program returns on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The roundtable today, accomplished panelists, Branford Marsalis, jazz musician, Arlie Petters, professor of math, physics, and business administration at Duke, Juliana Makachi Infa Ebenye is a professor of English and comparative literature at North Carolina State. So, Branford, you are just back from Israel, a place where there, in a part of the world where there's a great deal of tension and What's happening there? Did you have a sense to take any of that in? You can be very busy on the road, but
I always take things in.
Yeah,
it's just my I'm a people watcher. It's probably the ironic thing is the security to get inside of Israel is absolutely insane for reasons that we all understand. But the odd thing is, once you get in, it's one of the safest places in the world.
Well, yeah,
I mean, kids. I was in this hotel, and the kids were little kids, 3 or 4 years old, running around the hotel lobby at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then they see you, and they go, hello. You think about, you know, a Holiday Inn in America. Ah, stranger. So it was like this thing. You say, wow, it's really out there. But when you – then we got back. We were in the lot, which is right, ironically, on the Egyptian border. I mean, you could walk to the Egyptian border. You can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 300 yards away. And one of the things that I was saying is, you know, maybe we'll be able to, because Sinai is right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go through the border, go to Sinai, get a meal, and then everything went haywire. I was like, well, not now, no. So we were there, and it was kind of bizarre to be sitting in a hotel, and you're on the Red Sea, and people are having fun, and everything is great. And literally 300 yards away from me is absolute chaos that I cannot see from where I am. And it wasn't lost on me. I was like, man, this is different.
Arlie Petters?
So one thing I will never forget when I went to Israel, so the extreme security, as Branford mentioned. Then when I arrived, my grandma was with me. Love, friendship. I mean, it was such a tremendous outpouring that was in dire contradiction to the perceptions I had of the region.
Right.
Interestingly, when the taxi – we were in Jerusalem, by the way. When the taxi driver took us over to the Palestinian side, he pulled his gun out and put it in the middle of the air between the two seats. And that, to me, was the wake-up of the tension in the region.
Oh, there's real tension there. There's real tension.
Well, and of course, that security is at the point of a gun, and you don't see it. But there is a strictly segregated society with second-class citizens, Palestinian, even Israeli citizens, treated overtly as second-class citizens in their ghettos. They're not, and talk about families separated, can't get to see your mother and your father because they're in the Swiss cheese that is now Israel proper. That's not even to talk about the West Bank and Sinai. Situations like that, at the point of a gun, you can keep it calm, and on my side of the wall, everything's friendly. But that's because
but it's
we
not
haven't
really
dealt
calm.
With the tension.
It's not really calm. There are these in my view. Or I got to preface that. I mean, it used to be that you could just infer things and not have to. But in my view, there are these three strata. They're the children and the grandchildren of Holocaust victims. And they have one mindset. And now we're in the third generation of Israeli, born in Israel, Israeli citizens. And they're of a very, very different mindset. They kind of see, without having to actually assert it, that the current system is an unsustainable system when you're surrounded by 400 million Arabs. And in everyday activity and little bits, they choose to try to change the dynamic. I spent some time in Nazareth, which is an Arab town, and right across the road is the old guard, which is a place called, what do they call it? Oh, and it's really interesting, the choice of words. There's not far away, there's a second city that was built near Nazareth. And according to friends of mine, and it's something I can't verify, Arabs are overtly discouraged from trying to buy homes over there. It's called Upper Nazareth. And the original city of Nazareth is surrounded on all sides by Jewish settlements, so that the only way the Arab community can expand is vertically. They can't expand horizontally. But inside of Nazareth proper, there are European Israelis who have chosen to, and Jews who have chosen to just move into Nazareth. And that little thing, you know, I had a very funny conversation with a friend of mine. It just occurred to me. We were in a restaurant, we were in a bar in Nazareth. And I forgot what we were talking about. We were talking about hookahs, you know, because in the Arab word is different. So he turns to the guy, to an elderly gentleman, and asks him in Hebrew, what is it? And the guy responds to him in Arabic. And he turns to me and he says, I mean, isn't that amazing? We're in Israel and he speaks to me. He doesn't speak Hebrew. And I said, I could be wrong on my dates, but I think that he precedes you here by a couple of thousand years.
You've only been here since 1948.
And then when I said it, you know, Avichai said, yeah, good point. And that's the difference, though.
Yeah.
There could be other people who would say, you're wrong, and blah, blah. And he was just like, okay, got you.
Well, Juliana, let's talk about that from your experience. You come here, you are sensitive to these things. You get pulled back immediately to Cameroon with that phone call, and now you're in a whole new culture and are disoriented. But you're living among people who haven't had that kind of displacement and can, I guess, afford to be oblivious to your situation. And if we talk about Israel and Syria, what accounts for that? How can there be the compassion that Arlie and any of us who have traveled abroad have felt within that population, and in those populations know the horror that that community has raked on another, the suffering that they have felt at the hands of other groups, ethnic groups? How can we live cheek by jowl and not have that sensitivity to those details that you talked about?
I think the fact is that many people don't want to just stop for a second and put themselves in someone else's shoes. Because once we do that and we put ourselves in someone else's shoes, the way we look at the world changes dramatically. Dramatically. I have no doubts about that. It's that we seem to think, and more often than not, people seem to think that I am empowered with the right to do this. I have the power to do this. So I don't have to bother and even, you know, say, let me put myself in this person's shoes. Let's just use that example of that bank representative, for instance. The fact that I had owned a home for 10 years was an important detail that should have made a difference to that person. They completely ignored that detail. And it was an important detail because that is a good mark of citizenship. They ignored it. And they acted on one thing that just said to them, maybe they had wanted to deny, you know, the loan request, and then they were fine looking for that thing that would enable them deny the request. And I think that's what the issue is, that you give importance to your point of view first, and not saying what is the other point of view. There are many other point of views that you can put on the table that might actually challenge what you personally think. I don't mean you, Frank, but the person who is in that situation. So people should stop for a second and just say, let me put myself in that person's shoes. But more often than not, they'll say, but I don't have the time for that. Yes, we do have the time for that.
You go ahead. And I would like to, what struck me when I look at Syria is you have all these bodies of children. And if you just put yourself in the shoes of the parents, I listen to some commentary and I'm shocked how insensitive some people are to that detail that is profoundly important, because that detail ties into our humanity. And if we are not going to set a moral red line, if I should put it like that, then forget it. I mean, this kind of selfishness will just lead to more and more problems that will become intractable.
Because I think perhaps we have the option of looking at these shoes and saying they confer a certain privilege on me. When I wear these shoes, I don't have to endure the suffering of that parent. Yeah. Because if I were to go there and really feel what that parent is feeling, that would be more than I could bear. With these shoes in this country, I don't have to face that. Everybody looks at these shoes and says, there's a lucky man.
I don't even think they think about it that profoundly. I just think that growing up in the Old South and learning those lessons, it reminds me of something that Barney Frank, the old congressperson from congressman from Massachusetts, just said when he was talking about gay rights. He was saying to the citizenry via television, he says, when you go out on these marches and you hold these placards, I'm sure it makes you feel good. You're hanging with your friends, but you're really not doing anything. He says, this needs to be worked out through the political process, and you would do more help if you would just call your congressperson. And it struck me in a way, because I think about a lot of my friends, the majority of them who lean liberal, and as much as liberals like to make hay about guys like Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh, what they are doing is the same thing that the guys at MSNBC do, is we are all raised in a way that we have ideologies or themes that make us feel good as people. And one popular American theme is that everybody who makes it made it on their own, and the people who haven't made it, well, they just haven't worked hard enough. Mm. And you hear this from the time you're a little person, and it works, and it feels good, and you try to, you know, like the whole idea of segregation, if you think about it in a different way, as opposed to the way that it's characterized in movies. You know, they have these evil white people who just wake up every morning thinking of ways they can make black people feel as bad as they can feel. Come here, boy. You know, you just like, you know, because I know that's what they do in movies. They invent villains but it's in certain subjects they should avoid it because it's kind of cheap and it panders. And I just think that I know for a fact that they're just these emotional responses you have to social situations that have been ingrained in you and you don't think about them. I remember once when I was much older, I went to a lunch counter and I watched this lady was very nice to the people to my right, and she treated me as horribly as you could treat a person. And because of the way that my mind was operating more like my dad at that time, my dad was always a person who could remove himself emotionally from situations. I said, how can I get this woman back? And I had eggs and some fries, you know, $3 or something. And I gave her a $10 tip, and I said, I want to give you this tip for your kindness and your consideration. And the look on her face was so much, there's no way that screaming and hollering at her, which of course gives her a defense mechanism. She now has to defend my attack. So we don't ever have to talk about what it is that she actually did. And that's a problem with that kind of behavior.
It's true.
But when I put that $10 in her hand, you should have seen her face.
If we had enough money to solve these problems with those $10 bills, that might work. Yeah,
it would work.
Well, I will tell you that this issue of putting yourself in someone else's shoe, and when you ask about the larger issue of setting up policies, I think if some threads in policy decision architecture would just involve looking at how this would really impact the other side. I think this unidirectional approach that we often see is very unhealthy. It is true. It's in the details. People are being killed. People are suffering. If you put yourself in that shoe, look at how shaken McCain was from his visit to Syria. And look at the strength with which he's voicing his opinion. That's a perspective informed from the details in the trenches. And I think some of this is missing in our policies.
I'm going to say that I think people don't want you to see that those details and want to obscure what's really going on. We just took a look at the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, and that's a city, yes. Birmingham, Alabama, an industrial city, a lot of factory workers there on two different pay scales. So it was the shareholders who were benefiting by that. First, low pay scale for all of them, and then a two-tiered scale that kept black people and white people at each other's throats. So they were emotionally responding to each other. And, of course, white folks, those white workers were worried about what was going to happen to their pay if we equalized it, because shareholders don't give up their money, so we're going to lower the white folks' pay, and that scares me. I'm going to have to give up privilege. Nobody wants you to see that, so that's where they want you to see Bull Connor.
Of course.
That's where they want you to see this guy with sunglasses, waking up every morning, and not a system that makes this thing work.
And this is what has essentially happened from the moment the New Deal was passed. That there were people thinking, how can we destroy this? And when they realized they couldn't destroy it, they said, well, let's dismantle it.
Piece by piece. Yeah.
And if you don't want to put yourself in someone else's shoes, how about just being consistent? This Syria crisis, I've been talking to people in Africa, and they are not sympathetic to the position of the West. And not that they don't, not that, I mean, they are pained by the people dying in Syria and all the refugees. They know that situation all too well. Their issue is, we are complaining and we have this outcry about, 100,000 people who are dead in Syria, and rightly so. We should have that outcry. But they're saying millions of children are dying in Africa at the hands of dictators. Civil wars have killed millions of people in the Congo, in the Sudan. They can just name places all over, and they're saying, what is an African life worth? So when you ask them to participate even in a kind of global conversation about what is happening in Syria, they don't have the patience to have that conversation, because they say, we are dying in the millions, and there is no consistent outrage towards what is happening here. So that, I mean, if you can't put yourself in someone else's shoes, and I understand that, how about just being consistent, about the message, about our outcry, about, looking at what is actually making life impossible for people around the world, We understand the issue of interest, Africans would say. We do understand. Africa is of no interest to the United States, for instance. But what is an African life worth? And so, when they ask that question, I can't answer it.
Well, and it proves that human life is not what's at stake. So whenever a politician makes that claim, the president of Sudan has been under indictment by the International Criminal Court for quite some time now, and we have not made a single move. Well, this brings me to the question of privilege. We won't have time to talk about it, too much time, but here's this news report from the UC Berkeley saying the wealth gap now the biggest in more than a century. Sure. Two-thirds of economic growth over the past 10 years has gone to 1% of the households. So since the recession ended, two-thirds of the recovery has gone to 1% of the households. Mm-hmm. Here it is. Overall, 1% income captured just over two-thirds of the, while 0.4% of the increase has gone to the other 99%. There's a lot at stake here, a lot of privilege to be lost, Arlie.
Yes, and I think this goes to the tension between capitalism and socialism. Mm-hmm. How do we keep in mind the welfare of the population at large and at the same time give people the freedom to engage in or capitalist enterprise? And I think the only entity that can help keep that in check is the government. It is just too big. And if we don't get the appropriate laws and the policies in place for that, no one will put themselves in anyone else's shoe.
The government as rulemaker or the government as owner? Because that dyad between communist or socialist and capitalist is the one that's been hurting us as well. It's about ownership. What about if that 99% owned wealth and had a stock, an equity stake in America, an equity stake in their own job, which we don't have? wouldn't be the government who owned my job. Be me. But and I'll tell you what, shareholders don't want to hear that,
that
either.
Good in
that is capitalism.
That's right. That sounds good in the movie.
I own
that's
my
right.
job. If my business no. increases, if this factory, I would get the increase
well,
in the value of the
that
company.
That Southwest Airlines does that.
There are more and more companies you know, that
and
do
it,
that.
A lot of times, there was an article I was reading, it was about a year ago, and it was about the fact that there was a particular company that made a particular device that I don't recall that was based in Illinois, and the man who ran the company in the 60s got the job from his father who owned the company, and he never paid himself more than $400,000 a year, and he refused to leave the house where he grew up because he didn't like what it said to the workers about how he valued them. And then that company, sometime in the 1980s, was acquired by another person. And once the company was acquired and the other person assumed it, he immediately tripled his salary, moved to Florida, built a 12,000-square-foot home. Mm. So a lot of what we're talking about is the 60s was kind of like the rise of individualism in America. And for the people who hated the social progress of the New Deal, they used individuality as the wedge issue.
The wedge. They turned it on its head.
And as long as we as a nation think of ourselves as a nation of eyes, it's going to be impossible to stem that tide.
Arlie Petters, I've got about 30 seconds, but I want to point out that if it had not been for affirmative action programs, you would not be a world premier scientist and physicist that you are today, given your background.
That is absolutely correct. And I feel that this is part of the great equalizer. Mm-hmm. But as we know, this is a big and important problem. And it ties in, I believe, at the end of the day, to being in someone else's shoe. Because after a certain point, I mean, why do you need to buy a $10,000 shower curtain? Right? That's hard for me to empathize with.
I want to thank all of you. Wish we had more time. Arlie Petters, Professor of Math, Physics, and Business Administration at Duke. Giuliana Makachi Infa Albeni is a Professor of English and Comparative Literature at North Carolina State. And Branford Marsalis, jazz musician, is going to stay with us. But I want to thank the rest of you so much for being on the show. It's great. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Stay with us on The State of Things.